If a team loses hope, concentration, cohesion, or coordination, it'll fail. It cannot sustain its victory. It cannot win. It cannot move on to the next level. It cannot become champion. Think about the teams that made a comeback through their hard work. Think about the teams that became champions in the final moments. Think about small teams that defeated big names. Success without a great captain isn't imaginable. When it's about the World Cup, everything is different. Pulling out a win and championship have different meanings at this point. In the World Cup, teams are representatives of nations. Representatives of millions of people who are glued to TVs and wait to feel proud and celebrate their victory. They're waiting for an excuse to take to the streets in a festive manner. The World Cup is a place where football and the identity of different nationalities are linked. In here, the success of a team is the success of a nation. It's obvious that the person who guides a team to success in the World Cup must be a very special person. The World Cup is a stage where captains shine. He isn't just a leader of a team. He isn't just a commander on the field. When we talk about the World Cup, he's the representative of all the people in a country. He's the one who resembles the people in his country the most. Remember the great captains? Bobby Moore and Kevin Keegan are the perfect examples of Englishmen. Dino Zoff and Buffon had striking similarities with people in Italy in terms of their behavior. Jean-Pierre Papin and Michel Platini were typical French people. And it's very hard to imagine that Mexican people are not like Claudio Suarez or Jorge Campos. That's why people in every country love the captain of their national team. He's a leader of their own type, someone who knows what they want. He knows what they care about and works hard for them as much as he can. The captain is the guardian angel of their flag. He's the commander of an 11-man army chosen from among the best in a country who fights with men from other countries to achieve victory, to gain happiness, and for the sake of their flag. The World Cup is a place that great captains become eternal. Those who fight, lead, and gain pride, the pride gained by a wonderful yet proud player, or the pride achieved by a successful and winning leader. Anyways, wearing the armband in the greatest sports event in the world can turn any player into a great champion. There's another side to the story, though. The captains from the World Cup. If we remember what role a mighty captain plays so his team achieves success, we could look for the greatest captains in the World Cup. Uruguay's José Nasazzi was the first great captain in history. Uruguay fans used to call him El Gran Mariscal, or the Great Marshal. He could play in any position that his team needed. His team became Copa America and Olympic champion. He had come to win the first World Cup in history. In the final match, Uruguay had lost the game 2-1 in the first half. José Nasazzi's leadership had the greatest role in the team's dream comeback. After him, it was František Planička, the legendary Czech goalkeeper's turn. He was a captain whose team became the runners-up in the 1934 World Cup. In the next World Cup, he showed the best possible performance. He received only one goal until the quarterfinals. His team had to play Brazil in one of the fiercest matches in history. That historical match was known as the Battle of Bordeaux. Two Brazilian players and a Czech player were taken off the field due to injuries. But Planička stayed on the field until the end of the match and resisted against Brazil's relentless attacks, although he had broken his arm. He was a symbol of a nation, the symbol of steadfastness by a wounded country that had been occupied by the Nazi Germany until just a few months ago. The next captain was Fritz Walter, one of the most popular Germans in history. In the 1954 World Cup, Walter was 34 and undoubtedly the most popular player back then. The most important reason was his strange fate. In 1942, a year after his first matches on the German national team, he was captured as a prisoner of war during the World War. He survived in Soviet camps for many years, and after the war was over, he returned to the national team. His persistence and perseverance turned him into a popular captain for Germans. Nine years after the defeat in the World War, when the Germans needed to revive their trampled national pride, a man who was hurt from the war and Nazism, but he hadn't lost hope or his steadfastness. Germany, under the leadership of Fritz Walter, worked a miracle in Bern. They stood up against Hungary, one of the best teams in history, and did what their tough captain demanded. They had lost the game 2-0, but they turned around the results to 3-2 and emerged victorious. The miracle in Bern was Fritz Walter's miracle more than anyone else's. He restored German pride. And we have to mention Carlos Alberto Torres, the captain of the best Brazil in history. He was only 25 years old. He was right-wing defense. Carlos Alberto was the captain of a team when superstars like Pelé, Jairzinho, and Tostão were shining. There was only one reason for that: the leadership that could keep a team of 11 superstars united. He had the final say in the team. The characteristic was noticed during the last moments of the final match more than any other time, when the right-wing defense scored one of the most spectacular goals in the World Cup. After him, Franz Beckenbauer had the honor of being donned as the greatest captain, a man who made his team the champion of the World Cup all by himself. After the end of the group stage in the 1974 World Cup, when West Germany lost the match against East Germany 1-0 and took the second spot in the group, everyone looked hopeless and felt defeated. Helmut Schön, the head coach, didn't even go to the locker room. Under those circumstances, it was Beckenbauer who spoke to the players and boosted the team's morale. Earlier, when his team players wanted to go on a strike and stop practicing, Beckenbauer talked them out of the decision. Without Beckenbauer's ambitious leadership, Germany wouldn't have become a champion. We could take a look at Dino Zoff as well, a goalkeeper who set a record for the longest playing time without allowing goals in international tournaments for 8 years and participated in the World Cup in 1982 when he was 40 years old, when many people said he shouldn't be on the national team. Dino Zoff stood in the goal for Italy when not many people would bet on its championship. He showed his unique character in leadership. He was the calmest and most resolute captain the world of football had ever seen. And then it was Maradona, a genius who was the Argentine team on his own. Maradona was so unbelievably great that all Argentine players were playing only to pass the ball to him. They would follow the instructions by the greatest captain in history. He was the epitome of Argentina as a nation, someone who managed to humiliate England and restore his people's national pride. The list of captains who changed the face of the World Cup can be a long one. We can think of Ferenc Puskas, the firm captain of the Golden Hungarian team, or Johan Cruyff, who took the Netherlands to the final match of the 1974 World Cup. We can mention Rummenigge, who captained Germany into two World Cups and took his team to the finals twice. Or Zinedine Zidane, who infused his fighting spirit, ambition, and of course craziness into France in 2006. And a long list of captains who were their teams on their own. Jorge Hagi, Carlos Valderrama, Lothar Matthäus, Lev Yashin, Bobby Charlton, Socrates, and scores of other great leaders. The face of football has changed a lot. In some teams, there are two or three effective players who lead the other players together when only one of them wears the armband. Some teams get extraordinary results through cooperation while their captain is a completely ordinary player. But none of these changes can undermine the significance of a captain, especially when it's about the World Cup. The World Cup is still an event where captains can flex their muscles and show off their leadership ingenuity, where the greatest stars in the world of sports take their teammates to the borders of pride and glory and turn themselves into national heroes. The World Cup turns captains into what they really are, responsible leaders. And the captains turn the World Cup into what it really is, the field for the most attractive international battles. This time, we can watch a little closer. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. The Treasury Department warned Congress on Monday that the deadline to raise the U.S. debt ceiling is rapidly approaching. President Biden invited House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other congressional leaders to the White House next week to discuss the debt ceiling. As Washington scrambled on Monday, 1st of May, to respond to news that the government could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June. President Biden's request for talks followed a jarring new projection from the Treasury Department that the government could run out of cash to pay its bills in as few as 4 weeks without additional borrowing authority. An unprecedented event that could rattle world financial markets and tip the fragile U.S. economy into another recession. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of May, called the top four congressional leaders, including House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, to discuss raising the debt ceiling at the White House later this month, following months of an impasse between the president and the House Republicans. President Biden's call came after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen notified lawmakers on Monday that the U.S. could default on its debt obligations by 1st of June. Biden told congressional leaders, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, that he wants to discuss on 9th of May the need to pass a clean bill to raise the debt ceiling. The president's formal call for a meeting follows a month-long standoff between Biden and the Republicans over a debt ceiling issue. Biden has not met with Kevin McCarthy since February. And earlier, on Monday, the House Speaker said he had not yet heard from the president about debt ceiling talks, despite the fact that the House passed a package to raise the debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion last week. The bill also includes spending cuts, beefed-up work requirements in safety net programs, and other measures that Democrats would not accept. Chuck Schumer has described the House legislation as dead on arrival in the Senate. Following the bill's passage in the House, the president told reporters he would be happy to meet with Kevin McCarthy, but not on whether or not the debt limit gets extended. The White House has maintained that the president would only accept a clean proposal to raise the nation's borrowing limit. A White House official told CNN on Monday that at the proposed meeting with congressional leaders, Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions, and invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, as well as how to initiate a separate process to address the budget and fiscal year 2024 appropriations. Reaction from Capitol Hill underscored on Monday that the partisan battle lines remain entrenched over this issue. Republican senators urged President Biden to get to the negotiating table with Kevin McCarthy, while Senate Democrats vowed they would not negotiate with Republicans on raising the debt limit. Senate Minority Whip John Thune said, "The news that the U.S. could default on 1st of June if Congress does not act reinforces the need for Biden to negotiate with McCarthy. Time is being wasted," the Republican from South Dakota said as he entered Mitch McConnell's office. But Hawaii Democrat Senator Brian Schatz accused Republicans of hostage-taking and said Democrats would not give in to that threat. "This is not just abnormal, but reckless. To take the American economy hostage, this cannot be tolerated," Senator Schatz said. "The only thing scarier than not negotiating with these people is negotiating with them, because they will never ever stop holding Americans and the American economy hostage." The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story. President Biden called the four congressional leaders on Monday afternoon and invited them to a 9th of May meeting on the debt ceiling, according to three people familiar with the calls. The White House later announced in a statement that the invitation had been made. This afternoon, President Biden called Speaker Kevin McCarthy to invite him to a meeting at the White House on 9th of May with congressional leaders Jeffries, Schumer, and McConnell, who the president also called today. According to a White House official, in this meeting with congressional leaders, President Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions. The president invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, the official said. And at the same time, President Biden plans to raise with them how a separate process might be initiated to address the budget and appropriations for the 2024 fiscal year. The invitation comes as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the U.S. could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June, less than a month away. The White House also confirmed the calls. The White House has repeatedly insisted that it's up to Congress and Republicans who control the House of Representatives to avoid default, even as the House passed a bill last week to raise the debt limit and cut spending. That bill is unlikely to pass the Senate. It's not yet clear that the invitations have been accepted by the congressional leaders or that 9th of May is a firm date. NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden has called the top four congressional leaders to a meeting on 9th of May at the White House to discuss how to avert a debt default, according to a White House official and Capitol Hill sources familiar with the matter. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned in a letter on Monday that the U.S. could breach the debt ceiling by 1st of June, earlier than expected, if Congress doesn't act in time. The letter sent shockwaves across Capitol Hill, with a threat of economic calamity looming as Congress and the White House remained deadlocked over the issue. There was little sign on Monday, 1st of May, that either party was shifting office position. House Republicans insist on attaching spending cuts to a debt ceiling increase, while Democrats vow not to negotiate over whether to pay the country's bills or default. The White House official said Biden will stress to congressional leaders that they must take action to avoid default without any preconditions, saying the meeting was scheduled to discuss the urgency of preventing default as well as how to begin negotiating a budget. Democrats have insisted on a clean debt limit increase without policy conditions and for Congress to negotiate over spending cuts Republicans demanded in the separate government funding process, which has a deadline of 30th of September. That is the appropriate place to debate and discuss our nation's fiscal picture, not in a hostage situation in which extreme MAGA Republicans try to impose their radical agenda on America, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a joint statement on Monday evening. We do not have the luxury of waiting until 1st of June to come together, pass a clean bill to avoid a default and prevent catastrophic consequences for our economy and millions of American families. Republicans cannot allow right-wing extremism to hold our nation hostage, Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries wrote. President Biden also called Congress's top two Republicans, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, on Monday.
hidden files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly or indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist, and professor, Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than 4 decades. Well, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers or in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and 2 mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for black people and other minorities, housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the Black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started From Inside Prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we create these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why are they terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us with what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement. Right, we've been engaged in a war against Black people since 1619. Right, if you really want to understand it. All right, when they had the Black codes, they had Jim Crow. Right, and they have mass incarceration. Right, the school to prison pipeline. Right, it's all criminalizing our lives. Right, our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated. Right, our people, and so that is the reason why they criminalize us. Don't want to give us recognition. Right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is their relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison. I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did made me stronger, made me fight harder. That's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my campaign, U.S. Petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by the guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisons exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement, perhaps thousands of political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world, and we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, right? Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we are in the bastion of white supremacy, you see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Well, they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence to end colonialism, neocolonialism, oftentimes they'll cut off the tentacles, right, of the octopus. Right? They freeing themselves. But what happens? The tentacles grow back. Right? And a period of time, the tentacles grow back, like what happened in Chile, in the Salvador Allende, right? Mm-hmm. As an example, when Pinochet took over after they freed themselves. And the same thing happened in various other parts of the world. Why is that? Because the head has not been dealt with. The head of the octopus. Right? We are in the head of the octopus. Okay? So therefore, as long as the head octopus maintains itself, right, then they continue to create the conditions for which they can reassert themselves in those struggles, in those moves that were successful at some point in time. All right, so for us, it is imperative that the world know, that the international community, progressive international community, understands that what they're dealing with around the world is white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, but we're in the bastion, we're in the heart of it, right? We're in the belly of the beast. And therefore, our struggle, ultimately, when we are successful, inshallah, when we are successful, the world will also be free.
Well, fortunately, you are no longer in prison. But can you tell us more about the overall conditions of these prisoners, even as we speak?
Imam Jamil Al-Amin, right, who they know is innocent of the crime that he committed. But because of his history of resistance, they had to lock him in the prison system. And he's been in ever since, almost 22 years now, right? They know he's innocent. The guy who committed the crime for which he was convicted of confessed, all right? But they hold him in prison because of his politics or who he is as a political person. Another individual is Varon Zambaro, right? This individual was part of the Black Liberation Army, part of the movement back in the days. He did his time, was on his way out the front door, had gotten parole, had received parole, on his way out the front door. And Anthony Gonzalez, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time, called the prison and told them, don't release him. He's still in prison today, right, because of his politics. Not because of anything else he's done on. He did his time. He guaranteed parole, right, and they won't let him go, won't release him. Another individual, of course, is Rushel McGee. Rushel McGee is the oldest political prisoner that we have in the United States today, right, and he was involved in the 1970 insurrection, August 1910 insurrection with Jonathan Jackson, George's younger brother, at the Bruin County Courthouse, right? He was found not guilty of shooting and he'd been involved in that incident. Not guilty by the court. The court would not accept that decision from the jury. Would not accept it, right? He's still in prison today, right? Mumia Abdul-Jamal. We know that he did not commit the crime for which he was committed. He's known around the world as a profound intellect, right, inside prison and outside of prison, right? They know he was innocent for what he did. They won't let him out of prison. We've had comrades who died in prison on their deathbed, and they won't release it for compassionate release, so they'll be dying at home, right, because of their politics. One particularly, Mutulu Shakur, right, the stepfather of the great rapper Tupac Shakur, right? He's terminally ill today, right? He asked for compassionate release several times, and they denied him. Or probably martial law, he's going to die in prison. Okay, this is how they treat us, political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Oh, really appreciate you being with us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Jalil Motaki. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the political prisoners that were mentioned by our guests.
Assata Shakur. She is the step-aunt and godmother of late rapper Tupac Shakur and the sister of political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur. She is 75 years old. Under U.S. President Obama's term, not only was she not pardoned, but the bail on her head increased from $1 million to $2 million. Dr. Mutulu Shakur. He is a doctor who specializes in acupuncture. He was very effective in helping people get off of drugs using his method. He was a black liberation activist. He's also the stepfather of rapper Tupac Shakur. He was charged and convicted for helping his sister Assata escape prison. He was eligible for parole in 2016, and despite being a model prisoner, his release has been denied. Currently, he's suffering from stage 3 bone marrow cancer, and he is 71 years old. There have been many requests made for him to be released on humanitarian reasons, but they all have been denied. Rochelle Sink McGee. Rochelle is the oldest political prisoner in the United States. He's 83 years old. He has only lived 16 years outside of prisons. The rest of his life he has spent behind bars. From the beginning, he was convicted of trumped-up charges based on racism. He says slavery 400 years ago and slavery today is the same, just with a new name. Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Mumia Abdul-Jamal is an internationally recognized journalist and black liberation activist. He was one of the founding members of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Panthers, and he has been known as the voice of the voiceless for his many years spent writing about issues relating to working-class people of color, prisoners, and the underrepresented. He has written 8 books and countless articles and commentaries from a prison cell on death row in Pennsylvania. He has been incarcerated since 1981. He's 68 years old and suffering from various diseases. Imam Jamil al-Amin. Formerly known as H-Rap Brown, he served as Minister of Justice with the Black Panthers. He is a well-known Muslim leader now and has been in prison since 2000. He remains in jail despite another man admitting to killing the person al-Amin was accused of killing.
Over the years, there have been many political prisoners to die in prison or to be released and to die within days of their release in the United States. There are petitions and movements around the world asking for compassionate releases for these aging revolutionaries. Well, we will continue to follow it up right here and let you know about their latest situation. But for now, I'd like to leave you with this quote from journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Conventional wisdom would have one believe that it is insane to resist this, the mightiest of empires. But what history really shows is that today's empire is tomorrow's ashes, that nothing lasts forever, and that to not resist is to acquiesce in your own oppression. Well, the greatest form of sanity that anyone can exercise is to resist that force that is trying to repress, oppress, and fight down the human spirit. Until next time, we hope that we hear from you. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is preparing to put First Republic Bank under supervision. The California-based bank appears to be the third such financial institution to fail this year. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. US regulators were recently battling to save ailing mid-sized lender First Republic Bank in what would be the country's third bank rescue in the past 2 months. The US Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, was said to be courting bids from several institutions for First Republic, which was founded in San Francisco, California, almost 40 years ago, and is now the country's 14th largest bank. Shares in the First Republic Bank plunged by more than 75% in recent days, after the bank admitted it had seen unprecedented deposit outflows in March following the collapse of similar-sized lenders Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. According to Bloomberg and Reuters news agencies, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, had asked lenders, including JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America, to step in and make a bid for the bank, and was said to be keen on winding up an auction over the weekend. JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America were among a group of lenders, including Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley, that stepped in recently to shore up First Republic with $30 billion of deposits. The global banking industry has faced a rocky couple of months as markets wake up to the side effects of central bank rate hikes. In March, higher interest rates and a technology sector slowdown combined to cause a run on California-based Silicon Valley Bank, which had invested heavily in U.S. treasuries and had to sell them at a loss to meet the cash demands of its mainly technology industry depositors. Just 2 days later, the New York-based Signature Bank faced a similar deposit outflow and was taken over by another lender. The Zurich-headquartered Credit Suisse was the first European casualty of the US banking rout and was taken over by rival UBS in a Swiss government-backed deal a week after that. Irish and European bank stocks faced a whirlwind month recently, as markets digested the fallout from the collapse amid worries about other lenders that could be exposed to interest rate hikes. The U.S. Federal Reserve is set to raise interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point in the coming days, while the European Central Bank, the ECB, is mulling over a similar-sized increase, which would mark a shift down from the 6 larger moves it has made since last July. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. US regulators are racing to secure the sale of California bank First Republic, which is on course to become the third American lender to fail this year, a sequence of collapses that has drawn uncomfortable parallels with the 2008 global financial crisis. According to reports in recent days, half a dozen US banks are in the running to take over the stricken First Republic Bank, with leading bidders including JP Morgan Chase, Citizens Financial, and PNC Financial Services. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, based in Washington, D.C., is running the auction process and has set a deadline for potential buyers to submit non-binding offers. According to reports, suitors were, on Sunday, 30th of April, weighing up which of First Republic's assets they want to buy before making final bids, raising hopes that a deal could be sealed, averting market instability when Asian markets open. On Friday, 28th of April, trading in First Republic shares was briefly halted after its share price plunged close to 50%, the second such fall in a week. Its market value touched a low of $557 million, down from its peak of $4 billion in November of 2021. Just days earlier, the bank revealed it had lost $100 billion in deposits during recent banking crisis, as depositors responded to the collapse of Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank by pulling their cash from weaker lenders. Although the rate of withdrawals has slowed at many banks, First Republic, which specialized in high-net-worth individuals, appears to be in peril, despite receiving a $30 billion infusion of deposits from major Wall Street banks in March. With time running out to secure a private sale, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation invited some of the largest American banks to submit bids to rescue First Republic Bank, which is based in San Francisco, California. J.P. Morgan Chase already holds more than 10% of all U.S. bank deposits and would need a special government waiver to add more. Eugene Flood, managing partner and board chairman of A Capella Partners, who serves as an independent director at First Citizens Bank Shares, and Janus Henderson, said, "For a large bank to buy all or most of the bank could be healthier for First Republic customers because it could put them on a broader and more stable platform." He was speaking in a personal capacity. First Citizens agreed to buy the failed Silicon Valley Bank last month. On Friday, it was thought that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was preparing to place First Republic under receivership before securing depositors' funds. Without an agreed bid, receivership is thought to still be an option. The website of Flipboard.com has also covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Federal Reserve has admitted in a report that it was slow to consider the strain on the banks from a sharp increase in interest rates, which has lowered the value of their financial assets even though it has increased their profitability. The mismatch has caused panic and a flight of funds to safe haven financial institutions. Officials at the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, have also blamed reforms during the presidency of Donald Trump, which had the effect of watering down the oversight of mid-sized banks such as Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic Bank. Michael Barr, the Federal Reserve's vice chair for supervision, who led the review, said the U.S. Central Bank needed to toughen its rules after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Michael Barr said Federal Reserve supervisors failed to take forceful enough action, highlighting regulatory standards that were too low, a system of supervision that lacked urgency, and risks to the wider banking system resulting from the light regulation of mid-sized banks. Michael Barr said, "Following Silicon Valley Bank's failure, we must strengthen the Federal Reserve's supervision and regulation." Jamie Dimon, the boss of J.P. Morgan Chase, has played down the risk of a spiraling banking crisis in the United States. Dimon claimed conditions were nothing like 2008 and 2009 for a lot of different reasons. However, he conceded that if U.S. economy went into recession and high interest rates persisted, that could lead to other cracks in the banking system. Under the terms of the First Republic deal, J.P. Morgan Chase will acquire all of the California-based bank's deposits and substantially all of the assets, winning out over as many as five rivals reportedly in the running. Jamie Dimon, the boss of J.P. Morgan Chase, said, Our government invited us and others to step up, and we did. This acquisition modestly benefits our company overall. It is accretive to shareholders. It helps further advance our wealth strategy, and it is complementary to our existing franchise.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, my dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. One of the keys of life we've been talking about is food and eating. And with the mercy and blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we finished talking about this topic. There's just one more thing I want to discuss with you today, and that is the sunnah of the Prophet. What did the Prophet used to do and when it comes to food and drinks? And obviously, Allah says in the Quran, وَلَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ. In the Prophet, you have an example. So if I want to learn how to eat and drink and do all these things, I have to look at my Prophet. I have to look at my guide, my role model, my hero, which is the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. I'm going to be sharing with you some hadiths in regards to how the Prophet used to conduct himself when it comes to food. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, he said, "Utiya an-nabi bita'am." They brought food to the Prophet. فَأَدْخَلَ إِصْبَعُهُ فِيهِ, and he put his finger in the food. فَإِذَا هُوَ حَارٌ, he found out that this food was hot. فَقَالَ, then the Prophet says, دَعُوهُ حَتَّى يَبْرُدْ, leave it until it becomes cold. فَإِنَّهُ أَعْظَمُ بَرَكَةٍ وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ تَعَالَى لَمْ يُطْعَمْنَا الْحَارِ, for it has more blessings and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not feed us that which is hot. So first thing we have to learn when it comes to the Prophet, he never used to eat hot food. One, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he says, كَانَ النَّبِي إِذَا أَكْلَ طَعَامًا يَقُولُ, the Prophet, when he is about to eat a food, he says, اللَّهُمَّ بَارِكْ لَنَا فِيهِ وَارْزُقْنَا خَيْرًا مِنْهِ. The Prophet would say, oh Allah, make it blissful food for us and give us something even better. And he says, وَإِذَا أَكَلَ لَبَلًا, and when he drinks yogurt, أو شربة, أو he drinks it, he says, اللهم بارك لنا فيه, oh Allah, bless it for us. وَارْزُقْنَا فِيهِ, and make it a source of sustenance for us. Okay? Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, and he talks about the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says, مَا أَكَلَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ متكئا منذ بعثه الله عز وجل إلى أن